Thanks. So we've got a list of, you know, we happy few who are still left here. We've got a list of various topics. So let me. So one, I'll start with raising a question that Alexandra and I were discussing, and just sort of, you know, putting out there. So it's the question on kind of global symmetries in string theory, particularly and global symmetries in de Sitter space. Okay, so it's the if you've got a, you know, it's a question, the axion, and the axions have a shift symmetry, which kind of naively appears as a global symmetry, but then one would say that, you know, in string theory that there are instantons that break this down, and so that, for example, this isn't, you know, this isn't an exact. An actual global symmetry, but there are, for example, you know, instanton terms which can then lift this and mean it ceases this to be a global symmetry. And the question we were kind of discussing and would like to just raise is, you know, so the extent of, okay, so that, you know, whether you can, you know, in de Sitter space, whether if this is small enough, whether you can ever actually tell that this is a broken symmetry. So in what sense is it, you know, is something a broken symmetry if you're not able to detect? So just say what we were thinking. So if you have a potential which is doing something like this, then you would say that, you know, something is, and that's the underlying periodicity, that if it's not a symmetry if you're able to roll down it. But if you're in de Sitter space, you are also permanently walking. And so if we take instead the limit where that you're like this, then the axiom will always be walking, just because it's in de Sitter space, it's going to kind of walk by a Hubble each Hubble time. And as this slope becomes less and less, then, you know, to what extent does it say, can one say that this is kind of a broken global symmetry? You know, I mean, how is there any kind of operation, you know, is there any kind of physical way you could tell that this is broken in the limit where as the axiom potential becomes less and less compared to the thing? And so, okay, so we were looking at this and the kind of condition that one had to say was that, so this is that right, isn't it, Alex, that we had that this is equivalent to saying, so Alexander, you agree this is the condition we,
that is the condition for eternal inflation,
yeah, and that was equivalent to the, and
that the assumption that we like is put that this is slightly less, or yeah, assume this to be already less than this, so that the denominator of epsilon is dominated by the
north. So then the question to kind of what I raise is then, you know, is this a global symmetry? If it's not a global symmetry, how can you ever possibly tell it's not a global symmetry? And if you can't tell it's not a global symmetry, what does it mean for it not to be a global symmetry?
I mean, it's not yet whether it's global symmetry or not, but also approximate global symmetries, which are very nearly,
With axioms, if you have any, I mean, in all the constraint constructions we have, if you have de Sitter space, yeah, that, I mean, having axioms that are almost massless and are just suppressed, you know, that only have a potential due to instanton effects that appear to be, you know, one, you know, make them arbitrarily small. Yeah, this, yeah, axioms do not seem kind of a difficult thing to include. You know, when we talk about how you construct de Sitter stuff, vacuate in string theory. You know, so for example, in LVS, for example, you know, you would say that if you have the minimum of volume, so assuming you have a de Sitter minimum of which is in the volume potential, and this is at large volume, then the volume axion, you know, would be suppressed by its potential, would be suppressed.
Yeah. I mean that when when this amplitude is getting suppressed and the symmetry is getting better and better, is because you are approaching some infinite distance point. So you expect also the Decator goes to zero the same way, such that it's forbidding you to take the limits. Of course, it's a, I mean, there is a correlation you have to check and detect what it means.
But what is it? So what does it mean? What does the statement there isn't a global symmetry? What does that mean? If you go to an experiment and say, you have a vacuum, you have a solution, you have a universe. What does it mean to say?
I think that's a pretty good question.
That there isn't a global symmetry.
How to quantify if we know exactly what you wrote there, right? How to write in terms of some modulus and then understand what does it mean to recover the symmetry in terms of moving in the model space. Then I think we can give an answer. But I agree that it would be better to have an answer that does not depend on how to parameterize the coupling in terms of the model, but just in a point of view of the
interface. That would like some operation definition, like an experiment of, how can you test the break in principle? There's always some global symmetry, right? For instance, the fact that the action has a mass means there's a global symmetry. So the fact that there's not a conserved current for the action means that there's no global symmetry. D hot star D phi is not zero whenever you have instant quantum the continuous subscription if you know.
So if the mass if the mass of the action is less than the Hubble scale, and you're doing cosmology, so you're in de Sitter space. What does it mean to say that axion mass breaks?
Sorry, but even in de Sitter, so suppose I have exactly mass as axion in de Sitter space.
Yeah.
Is it not true that d hot star d phi is zero? I understand that there's particle correction by the expansion of the universe, and it's confusing, but there has to be a way to measure that equation in a local experiment, and that's telling you what the things concerned.
Exactly, that's not clear. Can you do that? Can you do it for this thing being zero?
What happens is that in the center, because you have the static capacity to the horizon, so there's actually coming to the horizon. So that's why it seems not conserved.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like asking how you see electric current observation in our system.
The asymptotic state or the scattering in Hertz experiment by which to check that are not asymptotic in Gauss, right? They are not.
Yeah. So this is not the scattering experiment. Yeah. They can put a box on the star depends on what they have. That is true. But V hot star D phi, I'm just taking use of the definition of what a conserved current is.
So the kind of shift symmetry, if you have an exactly massless axion, you say this is a global symmetry or is this would be a continuous global symmetry.
How are we defining a global symmetry in the center?
That's exactly the question.
In field theory, global symmetries are associated with topological defects that implement the symmetry. I'm not sure exactly what that means in quantum gravity. The case where we can make reasonable statements is where we have some sort of semi-classical ADS system, and then we can translate that into the CFT tool. And their things sort of become more well-defined because of that. But in the center, we don't even know, we don't have a precisely defined observables at all.
So then one can also say, what does it mean to say that string theory has no global symmetries, which is a thing we would like to...
You're talking about practical questions or conceptual, principle questions. They're two different questions. Experimentalist versus principle. Principle, by that I mean, if you have a full estimate of quantum gravity, we know if you have global symmetry or not. That's the conceptual question. Whether or not that's accessible to experiment, that's a different question. But which one's the version you're raising?
Well, it's accessible in principle. That if you have arbitrary, I would say if you have arbitrary technology.
So estimators have a global symmetry is not clear.
Yeah, but maybe if we understood quantum gravity in de Sitter space, we'd be still wrong. But if we understood it,
then assuming visitor space is there, maybe what you think is normally estimated is no longer an exact object. It's corrected, it's changed somehow. And then we don't know anymore whether what we don't do from the estimated is really.
You're saying that basically our ignorance about the system prevents us to even talk about as a quantum system. What question is this that you want to ask? That's what you're saying. Is. Maybe. I would be sympathetic to that view myself, but I think the general idea is that if you have a quantum system, the scattering constant will define what are your symmetries. That's the usual definition. So.
I mean, yeah, so this is where you have no potential for the axion, where one, say, from the Lagrangian, there appears to be clearly a global symmetry. If you have a term which is L or some potential for the axion, but such that the mass of the axion is much less than the Hubble scale, then from the point of view of the Lagrangian, there is no longer a global symmetry. This is not a shift symmetry. But, you know, if the mass of the axion is much less than the Hubble scale, you know, what is it, you know, is it meaningful to, you know, is there any practical way you can distinguish?
That's a different question.
Yeah.
Practical versus...
No, but you can ask the question, is there a visitor and guy in this way that they could see this brain itself?
Yeah.
Maybe it won't. We don't know that, but maybe it won't. So you could phrase it as a condition, as a bound, saying that if you want the global system to be broken, the mass better be that bigger than something. Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, I mean, the mass scale being much smaller than Hubble scale is not measurable in the universe for which the lifetime is Hubble, for example, or there's no experiment you can do bigger wavelength than Hubble.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of problem. So you're asking a practical question.
I'm not sure conceptual and practical in principle, I think, are the same.
Okay,
yeah.
Your horizon is finite.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Mass scale is massless and horizon scale doesn't make sense for us. That's
Yeah. I mean, just we say this thing that string theory has no global symmetries, but this is then just to say, well, if you are in de Sitter space, well, you know, just what does that mean to say that, you know, in terms of axioms, if you can realize a genuine de Sitter vacuum in string theory, not like quintessence or something, if quintessence is a different matter, but if you have a genuine de Sitter vacuum in string theory, you know, what does it mean to say that there's no global symmetries? Well, that means I'd have thought that you can't have this, but this
would be
okay.
The same way that, for example, the weak gravity conjecture, no? That in principle quantifies how close you can be to the limit of the Coronet global symmetry. In ABS also changes and includes the ABS scale. Maybe also somehow here we have to include the Hubble scale. So what matters is actually whether it's smaller than the Hubble scale and not whether it's massless.
Yes, that's related to the distance between the visitors. That's root of lambda.
Exactly. So maybe that's the scale. I mean, that the fact that indeed, we cannot distinguish whether it's massless or smaller than the Hubble scale also matters conceptually for the global symmetry. This is what is standard, no? It's smaller than this.
Sorry, can I ask a related question? So one case where we say we have an exactly conserved current is when we're talking about the gauge current. So for instance, electric charge in the system, you really have a conservation current. Do you have any question like D hot star J? Is zero, but the electric charge is not conserved, right? It can come from the horizon. Does the photon get an effective Hubble mass?
Does the what get an effective?
Does the photon get an effective Hubble mass?
There's mass.
Even for the photon, even for things that we usually say cannot get a mass because of fusion second.
Sort of going on what Rainer was saying, it is sort of almost, it has a feel like a weak gravity conjecture in the following sense. So oftentimes when we're talking about global symmetries in quantum gravity, what we sort of think of is that we take some decoupling limit where gravity is decoupled, and then we look at the effective field theory, and we ask ourselves, does this effective field theory have an exact global symmetry, or does it have some approximate symmetry which is broken at some scale? What we expect, what we typically see, is that when we have approximate symmetries, that symmetry breaking scale is no higher than the Planck scale. In other words, in a sense, you can sort of imagine this limit where you first of all decouple gravity, and then you still see the symmetry breaking in the effective field theory. What's maybe a problem here is that if the breaking is below the Hubble scale, then you just can't take some decoupling limit where the gravitational effects go away and you're left with an effective field theory where you still see the symmetry breaking. And so in a sense, it's like asking the question, are the symmetry breaking effects stronger than gravity itself? And like in the theory, I guess, that you're writing down where the breaking, where the mass is very, very small, it seems like that's sort of not the case. There's not a limit you can take where you get a non-gravitational effect of field theory where you can ignore gravitational effects, but you still see the symmetry breaking.
For the mass to be impossible to measure, is it? For that, it seems to be essential that not only is m less h, but also the lifetime of the observer has to be sufficiently short, right? Because if it's exponentially long, then we can imagine we just do repeated experiments over a very long time, scales at larger types of mass images, and eventually we will filter out signal that will.
So you do repeated experiments on.
So I'm assuming that the lifetime of the zither is dramatically bigger than h.
Yeah.
And then I'm making experiments with energies much bigger than h, because I want to do that ignoring the Poisson horizon. And I do that very, 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 very many times. And then at some point I'll be able to filter out, I'll see this issue.
How can you fix the asymptotic state? Because that means you basically thermalized. Is thermalized part of the horizon?
Yeah, because
your asymptotic states of the scattering experiments are.
We can measure signals which are lower than our temperature. We can subtract the background.
Yes.
But for that, of course, we need to wait a long time.
So we have a signal that's
well, but you have to make sure that your quantum wavelength is the horizon scale, right?
Yeah.
So even if it's infinite time, it's always this is infinite state.
Yeah.
You will not be able to your experiment will be out of your horizon if you're doing your experiment. So you will not have access to the experiment. You will go out of your horizon.
Jacob wanted to learn at higher energy.
Yes, at high energies. I mean, you scatter experiments along the accident.
The tail part, doesn't that tail part go out of the horizon? I mean, the question is what do you mean by tail part?
So I guess the idea is that even a very small mass will have some time effect that are very high energies. So of course, it's on the ideal setup to measure things. So that's why it will take, huge time to measure these things.
No, but then you would say you have access to information outside the horizon, doesn't it?
No, scattering is a very, very high energy, a very short distance curves.
No, that you have. I'm just saying if you want to probe the quantum wavelength of that axis.
I don't want to do that. I just want to see the
how can you not see the
difference? If you scatter the potential, you'll get an action bias. And you can measure the effect of this in scattering experiments for very long times using higher.
Okay, so the assumption here, which is an assumption, is we're assuming that the H there is really thermal. It's really thermal.
Yeah.
Okay, so as long as that is not true, that will screw up anyway.
Yes.
But that is true as an assumption. I mean, it's certainly true. Certainly seems true for some different groups. I don't know about maybe over your very long time scales for the thermal
part. Yeah. Well, so that would be a question to ask if you are saying the supposition is true. It's true to like so that.
There is, it is true in the center that you can only get you can get arbitrary precise measurements.
Yeah, that is what I was.
So shouldn't there be some value of the mass where? You literally can't do anything.
I
have no idea.
I think that might be exhausted.
The only thing is, yeah. if you put this thing at the button, you demand the absence of eternal invasion sweeping, pause grading out the waviness of the potential, so to speak,
then you would derive conditions on, you know, slope over potential or something like that. A little bit like the visitor conditions, but weaker. Not something like V prime would be proportional V over F, if you want. So bigger or equal than V over F. So we would bound it, but you would still get, you know, in terms of slow load, you would still get like significant amounts of slow load allowed if you apply that to an inflation and one of the same kind of thing. So,
shall I carry on, or?
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess another thing which is, okay, so I guess in terms of things people can measure, it's the tensor to scalar ratio in inflation is one of where there's the biggest intersections between, you know, things we talk about in the swampland and stuff that observational cosmologists are kind of interested in measuring. And just a reminder that because this is basically tied to the field range in inflation, and I forget it's roughly R of 10 to the minus 3 is delta phi is about M Planck in inflation. I don't remember the exact number here, but I think this is, yeah. And so the... So I think there's some model dependence about, you know, that observations are sensitive to the kind of, you know, when the observable universe is crossing the horizon. And so, you know, so if you assume that inflation is... you know, basically homogeneous throughout, that then nothing funny happens. You know, you don't have something where you sort of, you know, you have something funny happening in the middle, that so that the 6D folds are all kind of the same sort of E fold. So I think you can change it a bit by saying that, like, there's something funny happens for like 7E folds where the observable universe crosses the horizon, and then something different happens for the next 50 E folds in terms of fiddling about the exact value of this a little bit. But I think if it's homogeneous throughout the 16 E folds, I think then you have to be dealing with a Transplanckian inflation. And then this is obviously important for us because this is what we want to constrain, and this is important for the observers because this is what they're trying to measure. And so I think feeding into this, I think things which are kind of important from our perspective are that, you know, in all these applications of the distance conjecture or other related things, you know, the question of kind of exactly what this parameter alpha is up here, that if you're talking about, you know, a scale over which the potential gets modified or a scale of which a tower of states comes down, it really matters whether this is, you know, 2 or 0.5 or 1 or, you know, 2 pi. Is this 0.1? Is this 1? You know, is this 10? Is kind of... it's important observationally. If you want to say that some observation of R, you know, could be consistent or inconsistent with quantum gravity.
When you're talking about this, are you imagining, what are you talking about exactly? Like, is there some sort of pre-factor on this thing? It's like the potential, or is there any energy scale
Okay, so I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, so if you check something like the distance conjecture, the idea that you've got a tower of states that will, you know, that will come down and you will move a distance in transplant, and then you'll have a big tower of states that come down. If you have some kind of picture, which I think generally seems to work quite well in string compactifications, that, you know, you can view the potential, the low energy potential, in part as a thing of kind of integrating out the higher dimensional heavy modes. So, for example, if you have a Kolmogorov-Weinberg potential, you know, then there's a term which is like lambda squared M3 half squared.
Sure. So, if you're thinking about the tower of states, there's like an M0 which sets the spacing of the tower. Like the masses go like M0 times the minus half.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah.
M0 is also relevant.
Yes. Yeah. So the M0 is relevant, but then the alpha is important over kind of basically saying over what scale you can try and keep the potential flat. So just one, you know, intuitive way one might think about this is that. Yeah, so in a Kolmogorov-Weinberg potential, you know, you've often got this sort of term. where lambda is the cutoff. And so a natural thing for lambda is the KK scale. So if you put lambda, say, MKK or M string, you know, then your low energy potential, you know, in a could quite reasonably look something like this, and this kind of doesn't actually work, this works reasonably well. And so then, you know, what happens to the tower is very relevant, because you would expect it on, in kind of ordinary, you know, from an ordinary field theory perspective, be basically setting what the value of the potential is. And if this is changing rapidly, the potential is changing rapidly, and if the potential is just changing rapidly, it's not flat. And if the potential is not flat, you haven't got inflation. So then the question of what goes here is then, you know, exactly what this numerical coefficient is then, I think, one of the biggest intersections between the swampland and observation cosmology, because then it ties to basically saying, you know, or I think it's very closely related to the question of, you know, how flat, over what distance in field space can you keep the inflaton flat?
Yeah. Or if you want, even there's a related question. If this coefficient is the one question, the other question is when you say there's the KK modes, and depending on what your inflaton is, when do the KK modes start to react to pushing the inflaton in this way? From which distance on? It could be that you screen it for a while.
So in extreme models, I think that, for example, you then have complex state. The bounds they get that very close to 1 for alpha. Suppose it was 1, then what would you say about applications to communication? So it's strictly as 1, just for the.
So if it's strictly 1, I think you're basically tied to the thing that kind of 1 in Planck is the natural limit, if it's strictly 1.
I think with 1, you get 5 times in Planck. Sorry, because now, well, of course, it depends, okay. Now, it depends when, if the tower is coming live, I mean, when you are saying that the inflation stops, right? Would be the wrong thing. So you could say, you could take a conservative approach and say that you want this tower to be higher than the Hubble scale. Maybe it worked before that, but if you did that, then ultimately the delta phi is going to be 1 over alpha, going to be 1, the log of the Planck mass over the Hubble scale, and then it's this log allows you to go, I think, about 4 or 5 times over. So it depends. Yeah, you put your cut off the Hubble
scale. 4 or 5 degrees. 4 or 5 gives you what part? Just to get a ballpark.
Depending on how the shape of the potential is, I mean, like 5 Planck units in like exponential potentials, like, you know, solids.
So there's a universal state.
You are adding somewhere between 0.003 and 0.03.
So when you're saying with the log M over Hubble scale, is that coming from when the heavy modes are coming down to the Hubble scale, or?
Just saying, like, this exponential, right?
Yep.
So now you have that, I'm imposing that this mass of the tower is bigger or equal on the Hubble scale. So you can get from there the value of delta phi, and it's going to be related to the log of the Planck mass over the Hubble scale.
So I think that is an I agree with that constraint, but I think it's kind of much stronger. Because I think, I mean, so this kind of thing, you know, is that I think often the potential will, you know, the modes, the KK modes will still be way above the Hubble scale, and they will already have modified the potential drastically in a way. I mean that's the kind of the strongest thing to say, that the KK modes have actually got down to the Hubble scale.
I mean, it's the one that makes it more sure that you're not efficient on trouble.
It depends which way, but yeah.
I mean, you were saying that your common Wyman potential argument says you can't go more than a Planck in this space.
Yeah.
Right? That's stronger than.
Yeah, conservative in terms of want to make sure that nothing goes back. That's what.
Yeah, but I would still argue that your argument holds at the moment that the inflaton is directly affecting the KK mode mass.
Yes, yeah.
You know, like in modulus direction, yeah.
If it does that, then
I guess, yeah.
So what
did
you get exactly?
Sorry. If the inflaton moves over one,
I mean, the inflaton is a modulus and it is directly controlling the KK mode mass as an exponential.
Yes, but then, so, yes, but now let's continue that thought. So somehow I moved the inflaton out, and at one implant, the KK would start coming down. And I keep moving the inflaton to 5 implant. Who tells you that inflation doesn't work from 5 implant to 1 just because the KK would come down?
So the, I think the 5M Planck was the statement that you, where I think if you were doing large field inflation at 10 to the 16 GeV, you know, you would heavy modes would have to come down to the actual Hubble, to the actual scale, the Hubble scale. So then you've got new modes that have entered the, yeah, are at the Hubble scale, or if you carry on going, are lighter than the Hubble scale. And this certainly seems to be a problem. Yeah.
I think what your argument is, if I go try to get this, and there's a point, if the modes come down one after the other, and you integrate them in, it will change your EFT. It may not destroy inflation necessarily just after one mode being integrated in.
So it's a model dependent thing.
I don't know. I mean, I know that if I integrate in infinitely many, eventually then I don't know what I'm doing.
But I think it's not what we face in reality, right?
Yeah.
There are two modes becoming light, and you will probably need to study an explicit model to see how they affect inflation.
I think that's true indeed. I mean, from that argument, I think the mode coming in one after the other, you cannot, you have to check. I mean, just adding one mode doesn't necessarily kill, so it can, but it does not happen. So that's something that is definitely true.
That's true. I mean, the only move is that passing the power scale, I mean,
it's
not there, so.
I think it depends on not in everything, right? I mean, if I go from 1 implant to 5 implant, it's not a huge factor. I think it's equal to the -5, and then it depends what M0 is. How do they actually couple to the inflaton themselves? How do these fields couple that come into the inflaton?
I can put, I mean, if you want, like, the M0 can have, like, N, if you give a number, no?
Yeah.
Like, it's a cookie tower, N over the radius. So you have a scale times N.
Yeah, yeah.
And now I can have the same, I can do the same exercise I did, and I have the delta 5, and it's the log, the M Planck over 8, right?
Yeah.
And
plus log
in front, I have an N.
No. No, it's plus log N. You know, you're having N, you have N M Planck over H inside the log for the higher modes.
Exactly.
And because you have just the mass is N M Planck at the beginning, and then they come down, right?
I mean, it's, okay, sorry, I wanted to say, it's multiplied by, it's divided in the Hubble scale, right? So I would get the log of the M Planck times N over the Hubble scale.
Yeah.
And it's just a numerical factor. It's not changing the order of magnitude. So I don't see, I mean, it's inside of a log. So a numerical factor inside of a log is not nothing.
No, but what it means is that until the first mode comes in, you have, say, 5 Planck units or whatever.
But it's 5 units, I'm assuming that there's a 5 order of magnitude between the Planck scale and Planck scale.
Yeah, but let's say you have that.
That's not changing by a numerical factor.
No, but then the first mode comes in there, the second mode comes in 1 Planck unit later, the third mode again a Planck unit later.
But it's not 1 order of magnitude.
No, but a 1 Planck unit when alpha is 1 is just a separation of E, which is 2. It's like it's going on.
E to the -1, but E is 2, right? It's not 5, it's not 5 orders. I mean, 10 to the 5 is 5 orders of magnitude. E to the 5 is
not. We have assumed alpha is not 1. And then
yeah,
I think
trying to type in what E to the 5 for magnitude.
I think from one state to the next, you move one, effectively about 1 Planck unit more. Every further Planck unit, one more state comes down to the H.
The black line is a single field statement, so I think that's a competition between separation of scales and pushing the field range to be super.
I agree with what I'm saying is saying that just because the first state becomes light, saying that everything fails, I think it's too early because you might integrate it in and it may give you some change, but doesn't kill inflation necessarily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly if the inflaton controls the mass scale of this tower, there are direct couplings between the inflaton and the field.
Yeah.
So if a handful of them comes into a below Hubble, then probably use the estimate for the number of scales.
Well, we know the coupling, as you said.
Before the first of these states tells you the normal size, so, yeah. That is the possibility of the estimate. I think that hasn't, it's a good point.
Well, that was part of our model for the not the inflation one, but the late one in the work we did with Georgian Felt for dark matter getting lighter, the coupling was crucial.
And then I would still pose as a question, I think the other thing is that what if your infraron is not a module? So then it doesn't directly go into this decay mode as the phi that makes it equal to minus phi, but say it's an axion. And the axion, when you start out, will not talk necessarily to the moduli in such a way that it will appear as e to the minus b in the tau class. It will do, I agree with that, eventually, at arbitrarily large displacements. But whether it does so over a few Planck units is absolutely not a universal, I don't think you can make a universal claim at the moment.
There should still be some tau that comes down?
I think at some point they would put so much on the saxions, if you want, that then in the saxion, controlled KK powers, for instance, will come down. Of course, eventually, yes. I would not say that. You can't avoid that parametrically, but I am...
For
instance, or even if it's not an alignment model or something like that, say, if that works, then, it's the same thing. They will push eventually. So if I'm putting an alignment model with 100 Planck units here range for the axion, then in fact I will see at some point this behavior starting. But I think you have discussed it in your papers and in others, that that when you write down essentially a model that axions, so to speak, axions with these kind of kinetic terms, right? The question is, does this tau start scaling linearly with B, right when B goes one Planck unit in canonically normalized B field space, or does it initially go like tau zero, the initially stabilized value of this axion, plus some small number times some power law function of B, and eventually later takes over the linear scale. And that's only a model-dependent question. I have not seen any argument so far that it always has to start scaling like B in any part of moduli space at what one Planck unit distance.
Well, what we have seen is that if you take class compactifications in Calabino manifold, this number that we're looking for, like when it starts, is a ratio of fluxes. So yeah, there is a numerical number there, but it's a ratio of fluxes that I'm not expected to
deal
with very small
or large. No, I agree, but if it's, say, 1 over 100,
my point is that then we enter into how large the fluxes can be, like what translation, and so forth.
Yeah, I agree, but then what I'm saying is this becomes a model-dependent question, but you cannot make a universal statement that every axion model will therefore necessarily at one Planck equivalent axion displacement enter this exponential scale.
No, it's a ratio of fluxes.
Yeah, so...
But asymptotic, I mean, for us asymptotic, I want to remind that for us asymptotic means that there is an expansion that makes sense. That the polynomial terms are more important than the number of ones and so on. Doesn't mean that it has to be a limit, the whole range, like a Taylor expansion. As long as the Taylor expansion is working, then this is couple. You are able to take the Taylor expansion to the number to make there is a more important.
Also, your sense of this, what you call asymptotic, could be just starting a factor of 2 or 3 higher than what you need to live with for Fino reasons, right, in terms of field range. That is, again, model dependent. I mean, the field range where this, what you were saying, this the scaling behavior.
As far as this, I completely agree that we don't have particular value for this, and I think it's a very important question for the future. But also, if we are allowed ourselves to just take a large class of models, like class of modifications in Caribbean, or something like that, then we know what these factors are. It's not something random.
Yeah, but I'm not arguing about the value of alpha. I'm arguing about from when the behavior of the tower in back reaction to the axis.
Yeah. That's my point. It can be determined in the same way. Again, I'm restricting to models in which I can compute the things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to be myself.
But if you go to the SCS patch, you already bring yourself into the patch of the exponential already this started with. So if you give that being in that patch, think that you're
I guess part of the relation related to what between the special fields, I think it's a question of naturalness. That is, if you are given a model to orient yourself in a direction which doesn't go in the Saxon direction, I think it's going to be difficult or very highly fine tuned.
It will be arranged. Yeah.
Another looks a bit bizarre, even if you manage to find the direction.
Yeah, but I mean, like, we want to put at this moment a measure on model space. We don't even know how to do that, right? I mean, like, the point is, if you just look at naturalness in terms of how much like arrangement tuning I have to do, then I agree that the non-arranged models, the totally non-arranged models, will do your auto. No, it takes over at order one Hume and Planck.
Let's see the ideas that we discussed yesterday about the fluctuation of the quantum fluctuations of the field to set the initial condition. If you fluctuate a little bit, would it mess up your model? In other words, that much you cannot fine-tune that much. So, it's, in other words, how much fine-tuning you need might be something which looks artificial and in fact.
Yeah, but here, this is not about a tuning of initial conditions. This is about a tuning of, say, flux ratios, flux numbers, and or non-perturbative and brain potentials to get such a finitely.
About the direction of the Saxon versus the axis.
Yeah, exactly. This is the point. I mean, to which degree can you build in a finite, limited hierarchy that postpones the onset of the exponential behavior by tuning? There is tuning. It's arrangement. I'm not saying that. No, the generic model will do that.
It's not clear what is natural and is not. So you try to get single field equation because it's easy, but it's not very natural.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm not saying it has to be a single field. You could have, these days, these constructions that I think it was called Dante's Inferno. For instance, some kind of like two axion or several axions that wind if you want. Or Arthur Hegelka's unwinding inflation of the swamp or whatever.
I'm going to leave.
Thank you. Please.
Yeah. Yeah. Good luck. I hope you find a quick flight home before tomorrow, 8:59. I am in the UK. It's better, right? I mean, I guess. What? Yeah, but if you have a European carrier, the European carriers will not come here anymore. If you have a European carrier to get you back, they will not come here anymore. So yeah.
Yeah. So it started just as taking particular examples as one, so and precisely also my point at that time was that if one was able to engineer mass hierarchy, it would delay this effect, and so on and so forth. What we discovered last year, like this was with Thomas, that even class potential, is something that maybe is not strong enough when you have to work further, but for me it's very impressive, which is that we can really show that this linear behavior appears all the time. Like, doesn't matter what trajectory you take, doesn't matter what infinite distance point approach, what action. It will always happen. Now, I mean, that's mm. maybe it's not enough like for inflation, of course, but it's already, for me, it's an impressive result that is very general. And now I agree, now we have written everything in terms of what are the fluxes. And the question is how much you can tune these fluxes.
Mm.
I should say also that if I consider a situation, so now the difficulty here is that if I consider a situation in which I take a limit in which all the fields, all the scalar fields in my model space are important. It's not that I'm keeping some fields fixed and others taking the limit. Then I can show that this coefficient is one. Like the increased ratio of the fluxes is just cancelled. I mean, it's like it's due to the homogeneity of the potential that appears at infinite distance, there is no ratio of fluxes that you can see anymore. Now, it's much more difficult to find out this if there are some moduli that are fixed and others are sent to the limit. And this is still another question.
Or if you are totally in the, or if you are really totally in the interior of moduli space, if none of them are in.
But if you are totally in the interior of the moduli space, you don't have an axiom, it's an approximate.
Well, no, but you have in the Kähler moduli space, you have C4 axions, you have C2 axions. It doesn't have to be the complex structure directions, right?
No, but I'm not talking about complex structure, I'm talking any direction in Kähler geometry. Kähler moduli, whatever you want to formalize.
Oh, okay, I mean,
it's just a property of this asymptotic limit, of how the physics approaches the asymptotic limit, not of complex moduli. But I just say that for me it's already very impressive from a theoretical point of view, but I would like to understand better why it happens. But I agree it's not enough for inflation because...
No, I understand, yeah. I understand that before the guess that, before your work, the guess that these things eventually will shift linear with B was more or less a hunch, if you want, right? Kind of like expectation that was reasonable in like toy models, but if that is much, I agree, that is really progress, I see that. But the distance from when this takes over, I think, away from the infinite distance limits, I think is an open question still. So, well, in that context, I wanted to raise one other question, which is again pertaining to the towers in this direction. So, even though maybe it seems may seem heretic, but why do you expect a tower to always have to come down exponentially? I know at least of two situations, for again, in toy model constructions, where now as a reaction to axion displacement, there is a KK tower reacting, but it comes down at least for a while to the distance where things could be checked at the time, came down as a power law in the axion displacement. So one is this paper in 2018 by Angel and collaborators called Trans-Planckian Axiomonodromy ! I don't know how many signs there were. Yeah, they basically look at the B2 field, you know, in a warp float basically, right? On some but they look only at this region. This is the Klebanov-Strassler float, so to speak. And then there is a profile in here for the B2 axion that, you know, scales logarithmically with the radius. And then when they canonically normalize it, look, you know, in this case it's not the variation with time but with some radial distance at the throat. But then they canonically normalize and they show that they can go far, and then they look at the behavior of the KK towers of the, I think, the associated two cyclone, which is integrated, and it comes down as a power law of the canonically normalized axion, not as an exponential. So that is the one thing. And the other thing is this model of NS5 brain axion monodromy, there we looked at the KK modes of the wrapped two cycle as well, and they come as a power law of the canonically normalized axion. So what I just put it as a question. I mean, like, say the tower comes down, like, does it, again, like, no, maybe it's connected to this, like, does this behavior get shifted away over a finite distance before it becomes exponential? Does it always have to be exponential? Can't it come down as a power?
I think we have to be careful about two things. One is, what is that distance going to say? This country is not saying geodesic, it's saying shortest distance between two points. So you can, of course, try to go longer distances than the minimal path. And I don't know if you were here a few weeks ago or not, there's an easy counterexample. You don't have to go to that level. You just take the upper half plane, a great circle, which is a geodesic, which goes through irrational points at the real axis. That will never approach infinite distance, but it's infinite long.
Okay, so it cannot be that formally, you could say. But of course, we know in the case of the T2, of course, the distance conjecture works perfectly well. So the question of what geodesic you're taking will affect what you're talking about. So in the multi-field case, how you have torsion will depend on much more detail than that. So it's not a question of power. That statement is always true.
Mm-hmm.
You can also have this kind of geodesic I just told you, which has no problem.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The path going from irrational values never approaches infinity. So you have infinite distance from moduli space, of course, never get to infinity.
And therefore, the tower never comes really down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think, none of these examples is a counterexample to the distance, but it's not also what we're discussing of axiom monodromy.
Yeah.
Doesn't enter in the distance conjecture either. That's why I said it's impressive, because it's not necessary for the distance conjecture that these axioms also imply a drop off of the tower, because that's not impressive. So it's something that is not related to the distance conjecture,
right.
But it's something about the
potential. Yes,
mm-hmm.
It's a different
story. It's like somehow there are some constraints on the scalar potentials that...
When you're far out, basically, yeah. Yeah.
Well, mm-hmm. It's not the distance conjecture. And we don't understand yet why it's happening in non-distance conjecture by a manifold, and maybe why it doesn't happen here. Like, it's something to understand, no? What is the constraint on the scalar potential?
Or when does it happen? It's not clear, like, yeah, when does this behavior take over, so to speak? When does it start to behave like that? Okay, yeah. But you could ask the question, and even more generally, beyond these kind of constraints, now, do we always need that? Now, if we have an argument that there is always a tower, does the tower always need, even in the infinite distance limit, have to come down exponential? What's the reasoning for that? Yeah. I mean, like, why does it always have to be exponential, even in the infinite distance limit? Why can't it come down power law?
Good question. Even the distance conjecture, we don't know why.
Yeah.
That's a good question. We don't have a good answer.
I'm just posing it. I mean, like.
It'd be good to fight through it. But any would-be counterexample would mean that we have a weak coupling limit which doesn't look like the usual weak coupling, because weak coupling is always like that. So,
I mean, the weak coupling is
like string theory, yeah. Gauge theory, like canonical normalized fields, and all that will be that way. So you'll be saying that there's a new weak coupling limit, which is very different from any place we have seen, which is possible, but it's not.
I mean, I don't know any. I agree. I'm just asking.
A place to look for them will be precisely things like compactification or manifolds with exotic lengths, which is not weak coupling string, but exotic geometric lengths.
Mm-hmm.
Which could potentially be new ways of getting singularity. And these have been studied in various works, Eden and Thomas Doctor, and so forth. So yeah, those would be the interesting avenues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But even much more than that, why should it go to zero?
Well, that's the element of emergence.
But why should there be emergence? Why should there be something?
Yeah.
I mean,
if you assume emergence, then you can explain that exponential, but maybe not.
But you are assuming something then about the spacing of the states you were integrating in, right?
No, it doesn't really matter.
Don't you have to make them equidistant?
I mean, in the toy model, they are like that.
Yeah, but what if you change it drastically, for instance, would it still like integrate to the same behavior?
At some percent of composition.
I mean, one could, that would be a way of making that. Yeah, but for instance, when you have, there were these, you know, thing like in context of this clockwork theories, they had these duals that looked like a linear dilaton background or something, like where the K spectrum looks completely different, you know, from like, it's like bunched towards some limit or something. It looks really different. It's not an order one change. I'm just, okay. I mean, it's just a question that I'm posing. And,
I mean, those aren't, are those complete models?
But I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's
okay,
another way to argue, aside from emergence, that such a tower also has the effect of breaking the global symmetry by an order one amount by the time that you get to the Planck scale. So there's another, from the perspective of breaking the shift symmetry of the modulus, that's another way to justify such a tower.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just keep the question for the moment because I don't have a good answer either. Otherwise, I would tell you. It's just before we now claim that the distance behavior is universally always like that in the infinite limit, I would check whether there's any other possibility for another behavior out there that may seem in the end reasonable. Okay. So I have one last, so to speak, set of questions which I can discuss, which is essentially connected to the weak gravity conjecture, which is, I think for me, in a sense, maybe morally related to the question whether you treat like other conjectures, like the distance conjecture, you take them asymptotic or really, you know, at very small, order one field distances. There is the original arguments from the black holes, they demand the existence of some state, as you know, with charge bigger than mass, which is what's called the mild version. And then there's various strong versions. The one that seems to have most support so far is the sublattice conjecture. But for the sublattice, I think there are counterexamples. We have one with this, we found one with these warped throat constructions and then finding a light, very light axion-like state in there.
It's just very
smart. Yeah, and then sublattice and the means of order one sublattice.
I don't understand. You're saying you have counterexamples?
To the sublattice of order one filling fraction.
Order one. So what is the sublattice? So in the example that
counterexamples? It's like the filling fraction is 1 in 100 or something like that.
100?
1 in 100. So every 100th instanton. The dominant ones are coming from like.
Oh, yeah. Sublattice conjecture doesn't say it's true.
Well, I think initially, it is still a sublattice, but I thought the original formulation was that it was expected to be like rather full, not totally full, but rather full.
This is for axions, right?
This is for axions, yeah. No, it's not for particles.
And for axions, even if it's a completely controlled model,
you ask a model builder for a completely controlled model. Okay. No, we don't have moduli stabilization for the Kähler moduli get included. But it lives in the throat. It's depending on the flux stabilization of a KS throat. And I think that's a really reasonably well understood setting. And yeah.
So comment. The sublattice recovery conjecture, I mean, the statement is just that there's a base sublattice of full dimension. But in the examples that we looked at in the original paper, we never saw a very sparse sublattice.
Mm-hmm.
And so we said, this seems like a reasonable thing to think. I can't remember that paper very well, but I know that Matt Rees looked at that paper in detail and would say that it's not a counterexample. Not because he doesn't trust the warped throat part, but I'm trying to remember what the reasoning rationale is. I mean, part of it is the axion case, for one thing, is I'm not sure.
Is it just because it is still a finite fraction, so to speak, and therefore still covered by? Yeah.
First of all, it's very unclear to me how to map this example to a particle case. Right. I mean, oftentimes you can visualize on the non-compact fraction, mm-hmm. which is a part of the quantum statement, but in this case, it doesn't really work. And second, so we do get very, 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 very long axion periodicity. In this setup, in the sense that superpotential comes back to itself only after you go to, let's say, order 100 quantity distance. But the potential wiggles on it, wiggles are infinite. You don't get a completely
infinite one. Yeah, it kind of looks like that.
Yeah, I mean, also,
it looks like that.
This would be a violation of a strong form of sublattice, in the sense that they have to be relevant. The Benson analysis is populated at every point,
mm-hmm.
but most of these, or almost all of them, can be shared in numbers.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but I Oh, I see. Okay.
My understanding is that they would learn from the cryptology about the existence of these objects, but not
they could be speculated.
Why they would be looking at it.
Okay, and then if that, then somehow I had maybe that was my mistake. I always thought that you talk about the ones that contribute to the scalar potential in the end. Yeah. No, if you put that, then of course, no, then it's not a counterexample because then you, if it, they do, they are there. They just don't contribute to. Yeah.
There are sort of a couple of counterexamples that are more. So one is that there's a paper by Timo Wiegand and friends where they look at some sectors of some F3 model in 4D, and they didn't find sublattice. But this isn't a clear counterexample because they can only look at some sectors of the theory. It's also worth noting that, strictly speaking, just any, in four dimensions, any theory with a massless charged particle will represent a counterexample just because you get the logarithmic running of the gauge coupling to zero, unless you have an infinite set of massless particles, which you don't. Then technically speaking, it's a counterexample, but it's sort of a lame one because it's just due to this logarithmic running.
But there's an analog of this in the supersymmetric case, where you take n equal to 2 supersymmetric theories and you ask if the prepotential receives correction from every instanton.
Mm-hmm.
Every instanton is there, but could they contribute or not? That's the question. And that has actually been recently proven, at least in the case of all Calabi-Yaus, there always will be corrections or no corrections at all. In other words, if the theory is related to higher supersymmetric theory, there will be no corrections.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is any correction, it will be full, there will be not sparse. So that naively suggests, if you extrapolate that to the n equals to 1 case, you would have expected similar story, that you would expect it to be not sparse. You would expect if there is a correction to potential, it will be complete, all the instants will come. So the example you're saying somewhat puzzles me, if you're saying that that's a supersymmetric theory you're saying? Cecotti proves this in his paper using some general facts about Calabi-Yau moduli that anytime there is a correction to prepotential, it will complete. There will be no gaps. But or it's zero. And those cases are the cases where you get it from a higher supersymmetric theory, which is the work we're doing with Timo and with Aaron, which that will come out. So it's related to the fact that whenever things corrections are allowed as forced. And if they are not there, there is a supersymmetric reason for them not to be there, which we also explain.
But then,
the instantons that fully populate the lattice are E1 instantons, for instance, and in O3 ascending into homology, they cannot compute the supersymmetric. So there is a Suzy reason for this.
So
yeah.
Higher
Suzy?
No, n equals 1.
No. So what I'm saying is different. I'm saying that in n equals to 1, the only cases that we can have this protection of correction, if you have no correction, are the ones which are protected by a higher supersymmetric theory.
Okay.
That's the general statement that we are finding. But and in n equal to 2 is true, what I'm saying. In n equal to 1, we're having evidence. In n equal to 2, similar statements will prove.
Okay, but the statement is still there that because of the orienting folds imposed on your Calabi-Yau, that will split the n equals 2 multiplets in a certain way, that then, you know, the n equals 1 Kähler moduli will contain 4 cycles, no 2 cycles, and the ED1s cannot contribute to this.
The n equals to 1 orientable example from n equals 2, on the subspace of the n equals to 1 orientable, which inherited from n equals 2, you don't generate potential. You inherit it from the higher one, n equals 2. But in the new masses, if you get new masses modes, those will get potentials.
Ah, if they were like genuine n equals 1 instantons, if you want.
So as soon as you try to go away from the n equals 2 bottom base, so then you're gone. You're having your own superpotentials. So that's the protection problem.
Okay, but then I don't know of any instantons new instantons that are genuinely n equals 1 that would do that, that would generate suddenly potentials.
No, there would be, I'm saying, going away from the masses mode, there would be.
Okay.
So you would get corrections that, so typically you would be lifted, so the margin would be lifted away from the, trying to go away from the n equal to 2 subspace is that's what happens in our example.
Okay.
We haven't studied all the strengths and all that, but in all cases we find that there's effects that we give corrections which suggest dating. So protection, what we're interested in, whether or not you can have zero protection. The only cases we could argue you had zero protection for potential were the ones which are supersymmetric. So this is some kind of a principle that supersymmetry is the only guarantee to protect higher security. It's somewhat in the spirit of the strong version of the weak gravity project.
Okay. Then, well, the final question that I would pose or no for is, or is a discussion topic, and we had partially of that yesterday, so I'm not sure how sensible it is to raise this discussion again. We had it after partially after Tom's talk yesterday. This is this question about the Trans-Planckian censorship conjecture. So I just would like to pose the question. I mean, it comes down to if you have metastable disorder, what's the lifetime of it? It's connected to that. And the kind of like the older arguments say that, you know, you use non-perturbative tunneling transitions in some field direction and then you get these kind of very exponentially long lifetimes, which can lead to problems even if they are shorter than recurrence time. You know, there were things like Boltzmann brain problems that have been discussed. There's been a proposal from Trans-Planckian censorship that leads to something like, I think you said, 1/h log 1/h or so. But then on the other side, I mean, like, I have problems with squaring this conjecture with the treatment of black holes. And in black holes, they find, you know, as in the other situation, they find lifetime bounds given by the page time, if you want, when the stuff starts to leak out, which is like, I think goes like with m cubed or something like that. And then I would naively think there should be something like, you know, 1/h cubed, which is still shorter than exponentially long.
None of the people who support this system would say 1/h cubed is a lifetime. They would always go with the huge exponential. I think the analogy that black hole is not, even the people who are bringing that analogy don't subscribe to the statement that's the lifetime of the system.
Yeah, except that I heard there was a talk in February by collaborators of Juan who had a 2D kind of version of this island stuff where they tried to get a page time for Desider actually. And I'm wondering whether that wouldn't be. Is that the examples
are, I think, 2D. And I think they're misleading for reasons that I mentioned during the discussion session we had when Juan was there. But I think that the general idea that if the statement is that the Desider is either 1/h lifetime or 1/h cubed lifetime, if that's the debate, which is I don't think people in that community would be necessarily want to say that, because the statement is that if the relevance of the black hole comes is the first establishing that the center has a decay a la Hawking, but that's fast the rate. That's the question. Whether you accept that and then come to the point, okay, now it's a good analogy, let's see if it's 1/h or 1/h cubed. That's a different statement. So I think the statement of the analogy with the black hole is what I think is wrong. Because otherwise, what is that mechanism? Where is the 1/h cube coming?
I don't know either, but I still would think it is a valid question to pose, like, shouldn't we look? Maybe there is an analogy, we just don't understand it yet.
Maybe
there is a way of lifting this island stuff beyond 2D, which I don't know how, but maybe there's another. And I'm not just saying if that were, 1/h cube would be much more, you would still have Desider for practical purposes. You would even apply to inflation half. Abundant, you can live with quite a number of e-folds, it's just not, you know.
And it won't explain the coincidence problem.
That it won't, no.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's what I find is against the observation. If you had this, you would find a problem with observation.
You wouldn't explain maybe the coincidence problem, but you would still not run into things like, you know, Boltzmann brain or something like if it were 1/h cubed. It's far too short for that. You wouldn't have things like Boltzmann brain problem.
Boltzmann brain is a theoretical problem. I'm worried about more observational problems. 1/h cubed is way up in terms of coincidence.
Well, the Boltzmann brain problem I would also call observational because it would call into question why you are observing all of this.
But at any rate, that's much more relevant to coincidence.
Yeah.
The analogy with black hole, I think, is pushed too far. But if somebody has a more concrete understanding, that's the answer.
Anybody else, any comment on that? That was my last question to pose. I know if that's it, then I would actually close the discussion at this point. Thank you.